Tell someone else about the regret in person or by phone. Include sufficient detail about what happened, but establish a time limit, perhaps a half hour, to avoid the possibilities of repetition and brooding. Step 2. Self-compassion. Normalize and neutralize. After you disclose your regret, you are exposed to yourself and others. And once exposed, you face a choice about how to respond. Do you dress yourself down or do you pump yourself up? Which is more effective, initiating a round of self-criticism or tapping your reserves of self-esteem? The answer, it turns out, is neither. As someone with an unbending commitment to self-criticism, as well as a lifetime spent honing the technique, I was surprised when I went looking for evidence of its effectiveness. There isn't much. Self-criticism can sometimes motivate our performance when we criticize ourselves for particular actions rather than for deep-seated tendencies. But unless carefully managed and contained, self-criticism can become a form of inner-directed virtue signaling. It projects toughness and ambition, but often leads to rumination and hopelessness instead of productive action. Its opposite, self-esteem, can be more effective. Highly prized in certain parenting and education circles, where praise gushes and participation trophies gleam, self-esteem measures how much you value yourself. How good do you feel about who you are? How favorably do you evaluate your traits and behaviors? For example, in surveys, people with high self-esteem award themselves top marks for their looks, their brains, and their popularity, while people with low self-esteem make the opposite assessment. Curiously, neither evaluation correlates with how smart, attractive, or popular someone actually is. We all need some baseline level of self-esteem to survive today and flourish tomorrow, and efforts to boost self-esteem can lift performance and lessen depression and anxiety. But self-esteem brings downsides. Because it offers indiscriminate affirmation, unconnected to genuine accomplishment, self-esteem can foster narcissism, diminish empathy, and stoke aggression. Criminals, for instance, have higher self-esteem than the general population. It can also promote bias toward one's own group and prejudice toward other groups. Because self-esteem is comparative, to assess myself favorably, I often must denigrate others. These defects are why some of the finest social scientists of the last 50 years, among them Edward Deci, Richard Ryan, and the late Albert Bandura, have long explored alternatives to self-esteem. The most powerful and promising alternative, and the second step in the regret reckoning process, was pioneered nearly 20 years ago by University of Texas psychologist Kristen Neff. It is called self-compassion. Self-compassion emerged in part from Neff's recognition that when we stumble or fail, we treat ourselves more harshly than we would ever treat friends, family, or even strangers in the same predicament. That's counterproductive, she has shown. Rather than belittling or berating ourselves during moments of frustration and failure, we're better off extending the same warmth and understanding we'd offer another person. Self-compassion begins by replacing searing judgment with basic kindness. It doesn't ignore our screw-ups or neglect our weaknesses. It simply recognizes that being imperfect, making mistakes, and encountering life difficulties is part of the shared human experience. By normalizing negative experiences, we neutralize them. Self-compassion encourages us to take the middle road in handling negative emotions, not suppressing them, but not exaggerating or over-identifying with them either. Self-compassion is also something that people can learn, and when they master it, the benefits are considerable. Research by Neff and others has found that self-compassion is associated with increased optimism, happiness, curiosity, and wisdom, enhanced personal initiative and emotional intelligence, greater mental toughness, and deeper social connections. It can protect against unproductive mind wandering and help students cope with academic failure. It also correlates with less depression, anxiety, stress, perfectionism, and shame, and reduces symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. A 2019 meta-analysis of more than 90 studies showed that self-compassion can even promote better physical health, including improved immune function. In a sense, self-compassion delivers the benefits of self-esteem without its drawbacks. It can insulate us from the debilitating consequences of self-criticism while short-circuiting self-esteem's need to feel good through vanity and comparison. Its powers are especially evident with regret. In 2016, psychologists Jiwei Zhang, now at the University of Memphis, and Serena Chen at the University of California, Berkeley, explored the effect that self-compassion has in helping people overcome and learn from their regrets. The researchers recruited several hundred participants and asked each of them to list their biggest regret. Then, they randomly divided participants into three groups. One group wrote a letter to themselves about their regret from a compassionate and understanding perspective. The second group wrote a letter to themselves about the regret from a perspective of validating your positive rather than negative qualities. The third group, which served as the control, wrote about a hobby they enjoyed. The people who addressed their regret with self-compassion were more likely to change their behavior than those who approached their regret with self-esteem. Even this modest writing intervention led people to plan ways to avoid the behavior in the future, regardless of whether the regret involved action or inaction. Self-compassion appears to orient people to embrace their regret, Zhang and Chen write, and this willingness to remain in contact with their regret may afford people the opportunity to discover avenues for personal improvement. For a regret like Cheryl's, self-compassion doesn't mean exonerating herself for not making more of an effort to maintain her friendship. It means treating herself with the same graciousness she treats someone else who regretted a splintered friendship. It means remaining in contact with the regret, as Zhang and Chen put it, but not making the dissolved friendship the defining feature of her character. And it means moving past language like, "I really screwed up," which Cheryl told me several times, and instead recognizing how normal, universal, and human her regret is. A self-compassionate approach does not foster complacency, as some might fear. While self-flagellation seems motivating, especially to Americans whose mental models of motivation often begin with howling, red-faced, vein-popping football coaches, it often produces helplessness. Self-compassion, by contrast, prompts people to confront their difficulties head-on and take responsibility for them, researchers have found. As Neff writes, far from being an excuse for self-indulgence, therefore, self-compassion pushes us forward, and for the right reasons. So, drawing on the science of self-compassion, the second step in transforming our regrets is to ask ourselves three questions. If a friend or relative came to you with the same regret as yours, would you treat that person with kindness or contempt? If your answer is kindness, use that approach on yourself. If your answer is contempt, try a different answer. Is this type of regret something that other people might have endured? Or are you the only person ever to have experienced it? If you believe your stumble is part of our common humanity, reflect on that belief, as it's almost always true. If you believe the world has it out for you alone, please listen again to chapters 7 through 10. Does this regret represent an unpleasant moment in your life, or does it define your life? Again, if you believe it's worth being aware of your regret but not over-identifying with it, you're on your way. If you believe this regret fully constitutes who you are, ask someone else what they think. These three questions, which form the heart of self-compassion, bring us to the last step of the process. Step 3, self-distancing. Analyze and strategize. On the surface, at least, Julius Caesar and Elmo make an unlikely pair. One was a Roman statesman, general, and historian who was immortalized in a Shakespeare play and who lived more than 2,000 years ago. The other is a slightly manic Muppet with mangy red fur and an orange nose, whose exact citizenship is unclear, but whose last forwarding address was Sesame Street. Yet both of these figures are expert practitioners of the same rhetorical maneuver, illyism. A fancy word for talking about oneself in the third person. When Julius Caesar describes his Gallic Wars exploits in his book, Commentare de Bello Gallico, he never uses I or other first-person pronouns. Instead, he crafts sentences like, Caesar learned through spies that the mountain was in possession of his own men. Likewise, when Elmo explains his commitment to the life of the mind, he too disdains the first person. He favors constructions like, "Elmo loves to learn." Some people find Iliism annoying, although it doesn't bother Daniel Pink. But its existence as a style of speech and narration exemplifies the final step in the regret reckoning process. Talking about ourselves in the third person is one variety of what social psychologists call self-distancing. When we're beset by negative emotions, including regret, one response is to immerse ourselves in them, to face the negativity by getting up close and personal. But immersion can catch us in an undertow of rumination. A better, more effective, and longer-lasting approach is to move in the opposite direction, not to plunge in, but to zoom out and gaze upon our situation as a detached observer, much as a movie director pulls back the camera. After self-disclosure relieves the burden of carrying a regret, and self-compassion reframes the regret as a human imperfection rather than an incapacitating flaw, self-distancing helps you analyze and strategize, to examine the regret dispassionately without shame or rancor, and to extract from it a lesson that can guide your future behavior. Self-distancing changes your role from scuba diver to oceanographer, from swimming in the murky depths of regret to piloting above the water to examine its shape and shoreline. People who self-distance focus less on recounting their experiences and more on reconstruing them in ways that provide insight and closure, explained Ethan Cross of the University of Michigan and Aslam Iduck of the University of California, Berkeley, two prominent scholars of the subject. Shifting from the immersive act of recounting to the more distant act of reconstruing regulates our emotions and redirects our behavior. As a result, self-distancing strengthens thinking, enhances problem-solving skills, deepens wisdom, and even reduces the elevated blood pressure that often accompanies stressful situations. We can create distance from our regrets in three ways. First, we can distance through space. The classic move is known, unsurprisingly, as the fly-on-the-wall technique. Rather than examine your regret from your own perspective, "I really screwed up by letting my close friendship with Jen come apart and then doing nothing to fix it," view the scene from the perspective of a neutral observer. "I watched a person let an important friendship drift, but all of us make mistakes, and she can redeem this one by reaching out to meaningful connections, including Jen, more regularly and more often." You may have noticed that you're often better at solving other people's problems than your own. Because you're less enmeshed in others' details than they are, you're able to see the full picture in ways they cannot. In fact, Cross and Igor Grossman of Canada's University of Waterloo have shown that when people step back and assess their own situation the way they'd evaluate other people's situations, they close this perceptual gap. They reason as effectively about their own problems as they do about others' problems. Equally important, the fly-on-the-wall technique helps us withstand and learn from criticism. It makes it easier not to take it personally, which is essential in transforming regrets into instruments for improvement. This sort of distancing can be physical as well as mental. Going to a different location to analyze the regret, or even literally leaning back rather than forward in one's chair, can make challenges seem less difficult and reduce anxiety in addressing them. The second way to self-distance is through time. We can enlist the same capacity for time travel that gives birth to regret to analyze and strategize about learning from these regrets. For example, one study showed that prompting people to consider how they might feel about a negative situation in 10 years reduced their stress and enhanced their problem-solving capabilities compared to contemplating what the situation would be like in a week. Mentally visiting the future and then examining the regret retrospectively activates a similar type of detached, big-picture perspective as the fly-on-the-wall technique. It can make the problem seem smaller, more temporary, and easier to surmount. Cheryl, for instance, could envision how she'd react a decade from now, peering back on her regret. Does she feel bad about letting the friendship remain apart for 35 years? Or does she feel satisfied that she addressed her connection regrets with Jen or with others? When we simulate looking at the problem retrospectively, from the binoculars of tomorrow rather than the magnifying glass of today, we're more likely to replace self-justification with self-improvement. The third method of self-distancing, as Julius Caesar and Elmo teach us, is through language. Cross, Iduk, and others have carried out some fascinating research concluding that subtle shifts in the language people use to refer to themselves during introspection can influence their capacity to regulate how they think, feel, and behave under stress. When we abandon the first person in talking to ourselves, the distance that creates can help us recast threats as challenges and replace distress with meaning. For example, borrowing a page from Caesar, Grossman and several colleagues found that getting people to write about their challenges using third-person pronouns like she, him, and they, rather than first-person pronouns like I, me, and my, increased their intellectual humility and sharpened the way they reason through difficulties. Addressing regrets in the second person, referring to oneself as you rather than I, also strengthens people's behavior and deepens their commitment to improving future behavior, according to research by Sandra Dolkos and Dolores Albarracin. Similarly, deploying what some call the universal you, using you to mean people in general, can destigmatize negative experiences and help people pull meaning from them. And Elmo might be wiser than he looks. Addressing yourself by your name has similar effects. For example, another Cross-led project found that during the 2014 Ebola scare, people who were randomly assigned to use their own name, rather than I, in thinking about the disease, were better able to generate fact-based reasons not to panic about the outbreak. Equally important, self-distancing through language is neither laborious nor time-consuming. According to one neuroimaging study, its effects can kick in within 1 second. So, to gain the benefits of self-distancing, try any of the following. Imagine your best friend is confronting the same regret that you're dealing with. What is the lesson that the regret teaches them? What would you tell them to do next? Be as specific as you can. Now, follow your own advice. Imagine that you are a neutral expert, a doctor of regret sciences, analyzing your regret in a clean, pristine examination room. What is your diagnosis? Explain in clinical terms what went wrong. Next, what is your prescription? Now, write an email to yourself, using your first name and the pronoun you, outlining the small steps you need to learn from the regret. If your regret involves your business or career, try a technique from the late Intel CEO Andy Grove, who reportedly would ask himself, "If I were replaced tomorrow, what would my successor do?" Imagine it is 10 years from now and you're looking back with pride on how you responded to this regret. What did you do? Looking backward can move us forward, but only if we do it right. The sequence of self-disclosure, self-compassion, and self-distancing offers a simple yet systematic way to transform regret into a positive force for stability, achievement, and purpose. But we're still not quite done. It's also possible to move forward by looking forward, by foreseeing regrets before they occur. Here are 7 other techniques you won't regret. 1. Start a regret circle. Think of regret circles as close cousins of book clubs. Gather 5 or 6 friends over coffee, tea, or drinks. Ask 2 of them to come prepared with a significant regret. Let them tell the story of their regrets. Have the others respond to each regret first by categorizing it. Is it action or inaction? Into which, if any, of the 4 deep structure categories does it fall? Then, for each regret, the group works through the disclosure, compassion, distance process. When the gathering ends, the 2 people commit to adopting a specific behavior, for example, speaking up to an unpleasant boss or asking out a crush. At the next meeting, the others hold the regretters accountable for that promise, and 2 new people share their regrets. 2. Create a failure resume. Most of us have a resume, a written compendium of jobs, experiences, and credentials that demonstrate to prospective employers and clients how qualified, adept, and generally awesome we are. Tina Seelig, a professor of practice at Stanford University, says we also need a failure resume, a detailed and thorough inventory of our flops. A failure resume offers another method for addressing our regrets. The very act of creating one is a form of disclosure. And by eyeing your failure resume not as its protagonist, but as an observer, you can learn from it without feeling diminished by your mistakes. A few years ago, I compiled a failure resume myself, then tried to glean lessons from the many screw-ups I'd committed. Disclosing these embarrassments to myself will be sufficient, thank you very much. I realized I'd repeatedly made variations of the same two mistakes, and that knowledge helped me avoid those mistakes again. 3. Study self-compassion. I've been reading social science research and attempting to make sense of it for 20 years now, but few subjects have spoken to me as powerfully as the research on self-compassion. Understanding self-compassion helped me curb excessive self-criticism because I became convinced that berating myself, while masochistically enjoyable, just wasn't effective. Self-compassion similarly helped me see my idiosyncratic struggles as both common and solvable. I encourage you to look more deeply into this topic. One place to begin is Kristen Neff's website, selfcompassion.org, where you can measure your own levels of self-compassion. Her book, Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself, is also excellent. 4. Pair New Year's resolutions with old year's regrets. A core point of this chapter, of this entire audiobook, is that looking backward can move us forward. One way to imprint this principle onto your life is to establish a ritual. In late December, the temporal landmark of January 1 stirs us to make New Year's resolutions. But as a precursor to that practice, try what I call old year's regrets. Look back on the year that's about to end and list 3 regrets. Do you regret not reconnecting with a relative or former colleague? Or never getting around to launching that side business? Or telling a lie that compromised your values? Write down these regrets and make undoing the action regrets and transforming the inaction regrets your top resolutions for the year. 5. Mentally subtract positive events. To take the hurt out of a regret, try a mental trick made famous in the 1946 movie, It's a Wonderful Life. On Christmas Eve, George Bailey stands on the brink of suicide when he's visited by Clarence, an angel who shows George what life in Bedford Falls would be like had he never been born. Clarence's technique is called mentally subtracting positive events. Think of something good in your life, a close friendship, a career achievement, one of your children. Consider all the decisions and indecisions, mistakes and triumphs that led to that happy situation. Now, take them away. To use an example from the last chapter, I could mentally subtract having met my wife. The result is misery and gloom. But, as happened with George Bailey, the subtraction deepens my gratitude and casts my regrets in a new light. 6. Participate in the World Regret Survey. If you haven't already done so, submit your regret to the World Regret Survey, www.worldregretsurvey.com. Putting your regret in writing can defang it and can offer the distance to evaluate it and plan from it. You can also read other people's regrets, which provides perspective on our shared humanity and can help strengthen your regret reckoning muscles. As you read regrets from across the globe, ask yourself, what kind of regret is this? What advice would you give the writer for using her regret as a positive force? 7. Adopt a journey mindset. Achieving our goals can insulate us from regret, but if we don't sustain our behavior after reaching those goals, by continuing to exercise regularly or by maintaining the good work habits that led to the completion of a project, regret quickly finds its way into our minds. One antidote to this problem comes from the work of Stanford University professors Su-Chi Wong and Jennifer Ocker, who recommend what they call a journey mindset. Wong and Ocker have found that when we reach a destination, When we've completed a difficult and important task, we sometimes slack off and assume our work is done. But it's usually not. Don't just relish the goal you've achieved. Review the steps that got you there. Spend less time celebrating the destination and more time contemplating the journey.
I regret that I let a college counselor convince me that I didn't have what it takes to be a doctor. I wish I had believed in myself and at least tried. Female, 54, Maryland.
I regret wasting so much free time before having children. In hindsight, I absolutely was not too busy to learn Spanish, exercise regularly, or put in extra effort at work to attain mastery. Male, 29, Indiana.
Not being more sexually active. Female, 71, Michigan.
14. Anticipating regret. Live as if you were living already for the second time and as if you had acted the first time as wrongly as you are about to act now. Viktor Frankl, 1946. One morning in 1888, Alfred Nobel awoke to a surprise in the morning newspaper. On the pages of the publication, in black and white for all to read, was his obituary. A French journalist had mistaken Alfred's brother Ludwig, who had died, for Alfred, who most assuredly had not. It was fake news for the fin de siècle set. But what really rankled Alfred was how the obituary's headline encapsulated his life's work. Le marchand de la mort est mort. The merchant of death is dead. Nobel, a Swede who spoke five languages, was an ingenious chemist and an accomplished inventor. And what he invented were things that went boom. Detonators, blasting caps, and most famously, dynamite, which he patented in the 1860s. He built dynamite factories all over the world, which made him a multimillionaire and one of Europe's most prominent industrialists. Yet the obit didn't tell a story of technical genius and entrepreneurial pluck. It described a contaminated soul with a shameful legacy, a greedy and amoral man who became fabulously wealthy by selling people tools for obliterating each other. 8 years later, when Nobel did die, his will contained a surprise. Instead of leaving his fortune to his family, his estate established a set of prizes for those who, during the preceding year, shall have conferred the greatest benefit on mankind, the Nobel Prizes. The impetus for this gesture, the legend goes, was that premature obituary. Nobel glimpsed a preview of his future, and he regretted what he saw. Anticipating this regret, he changed his behavior to avoid it. If the previous two chapters were about regret through the rearview mirror, this chapter is about regret through the front windshield. Regret is a retrospective emotion. It springs into being when we look backward. But we can also use it prospectively and proactively to gaze into the future, predict what we will regret, and then reorient our behavior based on our forecast. Sometimes that approach points us in a promising direction. Other times, it can lead us astray. But if we understand both the upside and downside of anticipating regret, we can hone our strategy for pursuing the good life. The upside of anticipation. Like most large research institutions, Duke University operates an extensive library system that serves its students, faculty, and staff. And like most organizations of any kind, Duke University Libraries wants to know what its customers and constituents think of its offerings. To assess opinion and gather feedback, DUL traditionally relied on surveys emailed to its community. But it faced a perennial problem. Most people didn't bother completing those questionnaires. So, the crafty librarians of Duke hatched a plan, a simple experiment that sheds light on anticipated regret. In 2016, DUL sent half of Duke's 6,000 undergraduates a survey and told them that if they completed and returned it, they'd be entered into a raffle for a $75 gift card. The other 3,000 students also received an email with the survey, but the accompanying rules were different. Everybody would be entered in a raffle for a $75 gift card. But if the organizers drew someone's name and that person had not completed the survey, he would be ineligible for the prize and the organizers would select another name. Which approach yielded the most survey responses? It wasn't even close. Within a week, only 1/3 of the students in the first group had completed the survey, but 2/3 of the students in the second group had done so. The first instance was a good old-fashioned raffle. The second was what behavioral economists have come to call a regret lottery. Regret lotteries are one way that anticipated regrets can alter our behavior. With an ordinary lottery, I must take affirmative steps to enter. In the Duke example, by filling out the questionnaire and returning it. If I don't do that, and someone who does ends up winning, I might be slightly bummed out, assuming I even find out. But with the odds slim and my emotional investment almost non-existent, I'm unlikely to be devastated. However, with a regret lottery, I evaluate my decision differently. If the organizers draw my name and I haven't completed the survey, I know I'll kick myself. I can readily envision a future where I win the prize, but the gift card is snatched from my hands because of my own stupidity, laziness, or lack of effort. And if I anticipate that sinking feeling, I'll proceed like 2/3 of those blue devils and complete the questionnaire. Regret lotteries have been effective in changing behavior in many domains. They exploit a cognitive quirk similar to loss aversion. In general, we find the pain of losing something greater than the pleasure of gaining the equivalent thing, so we go to extraordinary and often irrational lengths to avoid losses. Losses loom larger than gains, the dictum goes. Similarly, when we anticipate our emotions, regret looms larger than rejoicing. In many situations, the prospective pain of regret outweighs the prospective gain of the alternative. That can work to our advantage. Anticipating our regrets slows our thinking. It applies our cerebral brakes, giving us time to gather additional information and to reflect before we decide what to do. Anticipated regret is particularly useful in overcoming regrets of inaction. For instance, during the coronavirus pandemic, the largest predictor of adults getting a COVID test was the regret they said they'd feel from not acting. If they avoided the test and then accidentally passed the virus to someone else, according to a 2021 study by Russell Ravert of the University of Missouri, Linda Fu of Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C., and Gregory Zimmet of the Indiana University School of Medicine. Another 2021 study, conducted by Katharina Wolf of the University of Bergen in Norway, found a similar effect with COVID vaccines. The anticipated inaction regret of not getting vaccinated and thus endangering oneself and others was a more powerful force in prompting people to get vaccinated than even factors like what one's peers and family had chosen to do. When we envision how awful we might feel in the future if we don't act appropriately now, that negative emotion, which we simulate rather than experience, can improve our behavior. A 2016 meta-analysis of 81 studies involving 45,618 participants found that anticipated regret was associated with a broad array of health behaviors. For example, one well-regarded British study by Charles Abraham of the University of Sussex and Pascal Sheeran of the University of Sheffield showed that people prompted to agree with the simple statement, "If I did not exercise at least 6 times in the next 2 weeks, I would feel regret," ended up exercising significantly more than people for whom regret was not on their minds. A pile of studies over the last 15 years has demonstrated that anticipating regret can also prompt us to eat more fruits and vegetables, get an HPV vaccine, sign up for a flu shot, use condoms, seek more information about our health, look for early signs of cancer, drive more carefully, get a cervical screening, quit smoking, reduce consumption of processed foods, and even recycle more. Anticipating regret offers a convenient tool for judgment. In situations where you're unsure of your next move, ask yourself, in the future, Will I regret this decision if I don't do X? Answer the question. Apply that answer to your current situation. This approach underlies the small but growing popularity of obituary parties, in which people channel their inner Alfred Nobel, draft their own obits, and use the written pieces to inform their remaining years. It's also the animating idea of premortems. In this management technique, work teams mentally travel to the future before a project even begins to imagine a nightmare scenario where everything went wrong. Say the project came in over time or over budget or didn't even get done. Then they use those insights to avoid the blunders before they occur. If one person embodies this approach to work and life, the apex predator of the anticipated regret food chain, that person is Jeff Bezos. He's one of the richest people in the world, thanks to founding Amazon, one of the largest companies on the planet. He owns the Washington Post. He visits outer space. Yet in the domain of our most misunderstood emotion, he is best known for a concept that he calls the regret minimization framework. In the early 1990s, Bezos was working in banking when he conceived a company that would sell books via a newfangled technology called the World Wide Web. When Bezos told his boss that he intended to leave his high-paying job, the boss urged him to think about the move for a few days before committing. A computer scientist by training, Bezos wanted a systematic way to analyze his decision, an algorithm of sorts for reaching a sound conclusion. And he finally came up with it. As he explained in a 2001 interview, "I wanted to project myself forward to age 80 and say, okay, now I'm looking back on my life. I want to have minimized the number of regrets I have. I knew that when I was 80, I was not going to regret having tried this. I was not going to regret trying to participate in this thing called the internet that I thought was going to be a really big deal. I knew that if I failed, I wouldn't regret that. But I knew one thing I might regret is not ever having tried. I knew that would haunt me every day. And so when I thought about it that way, it was an incredibly easy decision." Bezos anticipated a boldness regret, then made avoiding it in the future the impetus for his behavior in the present. The regret minimization framework was a wise move for him, and it's a useful mental model for the rest of us. Anticipating our regrets, we've seen, can improve our health, help us become billionaires, and earn the affection of survey-distributing college librarians. It is a powerful medicine, but it should come with a warning label. The downside of anticipation. To understand how anticipated regrets can go sideways, let me invite you to ride a subway, buy a microwave oven, exchange a Powerball ticket, and take a standardized test. Imagine it's the morning rush hour and you're racing to catch a subway train to work. On your way to the station, your shoe comes untied because in your earlier rush, you tied it so hastily. You find an empty patch of sidewalk, stop for a minute, retie your shoe, and move on. As you arrive on the subway platform, you see your train pull away. Drat! If only you hadn't stopped to fix your laces, you would have made your train. How much regret would you anticipate experiencing from missing the train by 1 minute? And a related question, how much regret would you expect to experience if instead you missed the train by 5 minutes? According to Daniel Gilbert of Harvard University, who led a group of researchers who conducted experiments about this very issue at a subway station in Cambridge, Massachusetts, most people forecast that they'll suffer much greater regret from the 1 minute miss than the 5 minute miss. Yet in reality, the amount of regret people actually endure is about the same in both situations, and it turns out to be not very much at all. One problem with using anticipated regrets as a decision-making tool is that we're pretty bad at predicting the intensity and duration of our emotions, and we're particularly inept at predicting regret. We often overestimate how negative we'll feel and underestimate our capacity to cope or balm our feelings with at least. As Gilbert and his colleagues write, anticipated regret can be a bit of a boogeyman, looking larger in prospect than it actually stands in experience. We're like bumbling meteorologists who keep mispredicting rain. As a result, the researchers say, decision makers who pay to avoid future regrets may be buying emotional insurance that they do not actually need. Overestimating regret has another consequence. It can cloud our decisions. Suppose that after waiting a bit, you've boarded the next train and made it to work. After a productive morning, you take a lunch break and walk to a nearby electronics store to purchase a countertop microwave oven for your apartment. After a brief conversation with the salesperson, you narrow the options to two. Both ovens are the same size, deliver the same power, and offer the same features. They appear identical, except in two respects. The first microwave is from a well-known brand, the second is from a generic brand, and the first microwave costs $149, while the second costs $109. Which do you choose? When Itmar Simonsen of Stanford University conducted an experiment like this, he found that customers split about 50-50. Half chose the more expensive name brand, half chose the less expensive generic brand. But then he introduced a wrinkle. He told buyers that shortly after they made their decision, he'd reveal how an independent consumer magazine rated the two choices. With that promise in the air, the buyers grew cautious. More people, two-thirds in fact, selected the name brand. People anticipated greater regret if they departed from the status quo, opting for the recognized brand, and then learned it was the wrong decision. So, to bypass that unpleasant sensation, the buyers played it safe. They became less concerned with making the smarter choice and tried to make the less regrettable choice, and those aren't always the same. Anticipating regret can sometimes steer us away from the best decision and toward the decision that most shields us from regret, as you'll discover again when you return to the office. After leaving the electronics store, you buy a $1 ticket for tomorrow evening's $80 million Powerball drawing. As it happens, I've also bought a Powerball ticket, and I decide to make you a deal. I offer to trade you my ticket for yours and give you $3 for it. Would you accept? Of course you should, and of course you won't. Both of our tickets have an equal chance of winning. If you make the exchange, your odds of winning Powerball remain identical and extremely remote. But you'll now have three more dollars than before. It's a no-brainer. But in laboratory experiments, more than half of people resist such offers because it's so easy to imagine the regret they'll feel if they traded away the eventual winner. Only when experimenters place the lottery ticket in a sealed envelope, so people can't see their original numbers and won't know if they held the winning ticket, are people more willing to make this type of exchange. In the Powerball case and many others, minimizing regret is not the same as minimizing risk. And if we don't anticipate properly, we end up making the regret-minimizing choice rather than the risk-minimizing choice. Sometimes that means no decision at all. Regret aversion can often lead to decision aversion, many studies have shown. If we focus too much on what we'll regret, we can freeze and decide not to decide. Likewise, in studies of negotiation, focusing too much on anticipated regret actually stalled progress. It made negotiators risk-averse and less likely to strike a deal. Your workday is nearing an end, but your obligations are not. Because you're an ambitious sort, you're also studying for a real estate license along with holding down your current job. Tonight is your first exam, 80 multiple choice questions. You gulp a cup of coffee and enter the exam room. You've got 2 hours to complete the exam. It's going well. You're proceeding steadily through the questions, marking your answers on the bubble form when a thought occurs to you. On question 23, I chose B. But now I think that C might be the right answer. Do you return to that question, erase your original response, and pencil in a new one? Or do you stick with your first instinct? At every level of schooling and professional training, the advice that experts offer is consistent. In surveys, most college professors suggest that you stay with your initial instinct because changing answers typically hurts student grades. The academic advisors at Penn State University concur. Your first hunch is usually correct. Don't change an answer unless you are very sure of the change. The Princeton Review, whose business is preparing students for every variety of standardized tests, cautions, most times you want to go with your gut rather than overthinking your answers. Many students just end up changing the right answer to the wrong one. The conventional wisdom is plain. Stick with your first instinct and don't change the answer. The conventional wisdom is also wrong. Nearly every study conducted on the topic has shown that when students change answers on tests, they are significantly more likely to change from a wrong answer to a right answer, sweet, than they are to switch from a right answer to a wrong one. Dull! Students who change their answers usually improve their scores. So, why does this wrong-headed advice endure? Anticipated regret distorts our judgment. In 2005, Justin Kruger, a social psychologist now at New York University, along with Derek Wirtz, now at the University of British Columbia, and Dale Miller of Stanford University, examined the erasures on more than 1,500 psychology exams taken by students at the University of Illinois, where Kruger and Wirtz were then teaching. Consistent with previous research, switches from the wrong answer to the right answer were twice as common as switches from right to wrong. But when researchers asked the students which they would anticipate regretting more, switching when I should have stuck or sticking when I should have switched, the responses were revealing. 74% of those students anticipated more regret from switching answers. 26% said it wouldn't matter, and exactly none of the students anticipated greater regret from sticking with their initial answer. Kruger, Wirtz, and Miller call this the first instinct fallacy, and it grows from anticipated regret gone awry. Getting a problem wrong as a result of going against one's first instinct is more memorable than getting a problem wrong because of failing to go against one's first instinct, they write. The regret produced by switching an answer when one should have stuck with one's original answer is enough to make the misfortune of having missed the question seem almost tragic. Haunted by the prospective specter of if only, we err. You err too. Because you didn't switch your answer, you just missed passing the test and must take it again. If only you knew about this research earlier. Anticipated regret, AR, can often make us better. But as your eventful day demonstrates, before you take this medicine, read the label. Warning! AR may cause decision paralysis, risk aversion, first instinct fallacies, and lower test scores. As a universal drug, anticipated regret has a few dangerous side effects. But that's not its only problem. Herbert Simon is one of the nearly 1,000 people who've won the prize named for the regret-anticipating dynamite mogul we met earlier in this chapter. Simon was a masterful social scientist who taught at Carnegie Mellon University for 50 years and whose intellectual contributions span many fields, including political science, cognitive psychology, and artificial intelligence. But perhaps his greatest legacy was pushing the field of economics to consider the human dimension in its analyses. In the pre-Simon world, the dominant economic models assumed that when people made decisions, their preferences were stable and they had all the information they needed, so they always tried to maximize their outcomes. In every instance and at every moment, we sought to buy at the lowest price possible, sell at the highest price, and relentlessly maximize our gains. Simon persuaded the economics profession that this assumption, while accurate in some cases, wasn't always correct. Our preferences sometimes changed. Depending on a variety of factors, we often lack the proper information to make the ideal decision. Besides, pursuing the very best deal everywhere in our lives could be exhausting. In many situations, we simply didn't care sufficiently to find the perfect option, the ideal roofer, the peerless fast food burger, and were willing to settle for good enough. Sometimes we maximize, Simon explained. Other times we satisfice. If this were true, and analyses of people's behavior showed that it is, the models had to change. And they did. For his work, in 1978, Simon won the Nobel Memorial Prize for Economic Sciences. It took a while for psychologists to begin exploring the emotional consequences of Simon's two decision-making approaches. But that moment arrived in 2002, when six social scientists, led by Barry Schwartz and Andrew Ward of Swarthmore College, developed a personality scale that measured an individual's propensity to maximize or satisfice. Using a set of 17 questions, they were able to identify which people pursued ideal standards, the maximizers, and which more often selected whatever met some threshold of acceptability, the satisficers. After administering their maximization scale to more than 1,700 participants, they connected the results to measures of these participants' well-being, and the researchers uncovered a surprise. Most maximizers were miserable. The maximizers reported significantly less life satisfaction, happiness, and optimism, and significantly more depression than the satisficers. When the scientists tried to explain the source of the unhappiness, they identified the main culprit. Maximizers increased sensitivity to regret, both experienced and anticipated. Maximizers regretted everything at every stage. Before they made their choices, after they made their choices, while they made their choices. Whatever the situation, they always imagined the possibility of something better if only they had acted differently. But these upward counterfactuals didn't uncork productive feeling is for thinking regret. They trapped people in ruminating feeling is for feeling regret. In their effort to maximize happiness on all things, they were pulverizing it on most things. And herein lies a problem. The wobbly beam in Bezos's regret minimization framework is that constantly trying to anticipate and minimize our regrets can be a form of unhealthy maximizing. Applying this framework at all times and in all realms is a recipe for despair. How then to reconcile these countervailing currents to gain the benefits of anticipated regret without becoming caught in its downdraft? The solution is to focus our aspirations. Optimizing regret. Our goal should not be to always minimize regret. Our goal should be to optimize it. By combining the science of anticipated regret with a new deep structure of regret, we can refine our mental model. Call it the Regret Optimization Framework. This revised framework is built on four principles. In many circumstances, anticipating our regrets can lead to healthier behavior, smarter professional choices, and greater happiness. Yet when we anticipate our regrets, we frequently overestimate them, buying emotional insurance we don't need and thereby distorting our decisions. And if we go too far, if we maximize on regret minimization, we can make our situation even worse. At the same time, people around the world consistently express the same four core regrets. These regrets endure. They reveal fundamental human needs, and together they offer a path to the good life. The Regret Optimization Framework holds that we should devote time and effort to anticipate the four core regrets: foundation regrets, boldness regrets, moral regrets, and connection regrets. But anticipating regrets outside these four categories is usually not worthwhile. So, under the Regret Optimization Framework, when deciding a course of action, begin by asking whether you are dealing with one of the four core regrets. If not, satisfice. For example, if you're buying lawn furniture or another microwave oven, that decision is unlikely to involve any fundamental, enduring human need. Make a choice and move on. You'll be fine. If the decision does involve one of the big four, spend more time deliberating. Project yourself into the future, 5 years, 10 years, at age 80, whatever makes sense. From that future vantage point, ask yourself which choice will help you build your foundation, take a sensible risk, do the right thing, or maintain a meaningful connection. Anticipate these regrets, then choose the option that most reduces them. Use this framework a few times, and you will begin to see its power. Our everyday lives consist of hundreds of decisions, some of them crucial to our well-being, many of them inconsequential. Understanding the difference can make all the difference. If we know what we truly regret, we know what we truly value. Regret, that maddening, perplexing, and undeniably real emotion, points the way to a life well lived. Here's a quick recap of what to do with your regrets. For an action regret, 1. Undo it. Apologize, make amends, or try to repair the damage. 2. At least it. Find the silver lining. Think about how the situation could have turned out worse and appreciate that it didn't. For any regret, action or inaction, there are 3 steps. 1. Self-disclosure. Relive and relieve the regret by telling others about it. Admission clears the air, or by writing about it privately. 2. Self-compassion. Normalize and neutralize the regret by treating yourself the way you treat a friend. 3. Self-distancing. Analyze and strategize about the lessons you've learned from the regret by zooming out in time, in space, or through language. To use anticipated regrets in your decision-making, satisfice on most decisions. If you're not dealing with one of the 4 core regrets, make a choice, don't second-guess yourself, and move on. 2. Maximize on the most crucial decisions. If you are dealing with one of the 4 core regrets, project yourself to a specific point in the future and ask yourself which choice will most help you build a solid foundation, take a sensible risk, do the right thing, or connect with others.
I regret that I wasn't braver and that I didn't do more to uphold our democracy. Female, 82, Pennsylvania.
I regret not being kinder to people. I was too often concerned with being right instead of being kind. Male, 41, United Kingdom.
Not going to see Prince in concert because it was a school night. Tons of school nights versus one Prince. Stupid choice. Female, 58, Colorado.
Coda. Regret and Redemption. When I first reviewed the data from the American Regret Project, I fixated on a pair of findings that annoyed me. Recall that the prerequisite for experiencing regret is agency, exercising some measure of control over at least some aspects of our lives. I wondered whether the people in my sample felt this sense of dominion over their choices and actions. That is, did they believe they had free will? Or did they instead believe they weren't actually in charge, that their lives unfolded as part of a larger plan and beyond their control? I posed both questions. I asked our 4,489 respondents, do you believe that people have free will, that they largely control their decisions and choices? A huge majority, 82% of the population, answered yes. Score 1 for personal agency. Elsewhere in the survey, I also asked, do you believe that most things in life happen for a reason? A huge majority, 78% of the population, also answered yes. Score 1 for fate. And let's declare the game a tie as well as a conceptual knot. When I overlaid the responses to both questions, the results were confounding. Just 5% of the sample disagreed with both propositions. Those people said they didn't have free will and that things didn't happen for a reason. Call this tiny cohort the nihilists. Meanwhile, 10% believed they exercised free will while rejecting the idea that events unfold for a purpose. Call this group the individualists. Another 10% held the reverse view. Free will was a myth, and everything happened for a reason, they said. These are the fatalists. But the largest group by far, 3 out of 4 Americans in the survey, maintain both that they have free will and that most things happen for a reason, two beliefs that seem to contradict each other. What to call this mystifying group? I thought about it a while, and after careful consideration, the name I've chosen to assign them is the humans. Open the hood of regret, and you'll see that the engine powering it is storytelling. Our very ability to experience regret depends on our imagination's capacity to travel backward in time, rewrite events, and fashion a happier ending than in the original draft. Our capacity to respond to regret, to mobilize it for good, depends on our narrative skills, disclosing the tale, analyzing its components, and crafting and recrafting the next chapter. Regret depends on storytelling. And that raises a question. In these stories, are we the creator or the character, the playwright or the performer? As a survey respondents told me, with their seemingly contradictory, bafflingly human responses to my perfectly logical questions, we are both. If our lives are the stories we tell ourselves, regret reminds us that we have a dual role. We are both the authors and the actors. We can shape the plot, but not fully. We can toss aside the script, but not always. We live at the intersection of free will and circumstance. Dan McAdams is a Northwestern University psychologist who has long argued that people forge their identities through stories. According to his research, two prototypical narratives wrestle for primacy as we make sense of our existence. One is what he calls contamination sequences, in which events go from good to bad. The other he calls redemption sequences, in which events go from bad to good. McAdams has found that people whose identities involve contamination narratives tend to be unhappy with their personal lives and unimpressive in their professional contributions. But people with narratives rooted in redemption are the opposite. They are generally more satisfied and accomplished, and they rate their lives as meaningful. Regret offers us the ultimate redemption narrative. It is as powerful and affirming as any positive emotion, but it arrives on our doorstep wearing a disguise. Just ask Cheryl Johnson. The regret she harbored about losing touch with her close friend Jen continued to nag at her, so much so that one morning in May 2021, she pushed past her awkwardness and decided to send Jen an email. "I suspect it might be strange to hear from me after all these years," the message began. Although they hadn't communicated in 25 years, Jen replied within hours. The two old friends then decided to meet for a virtual lunch to reconnect. "I finally got to say to her that I knew I made a mistake," Cheryl told me after that lunch, "and how much I regretted losing so many years that we could have spent watching our lives unfold together." Jen's response? "But we still have a lot of years left." If we think about regret like this, looking backward to move forward, seizing what we can control and putting aside what we cannot, crafting our own redemption stories, it can be liberating. It has been for me. One of my deeper regrets is that I wasn't kinder to people when I was younger. I'm not sure that happened for a reason, but I am sure I can find reason in the recollection. Now I try, not always successfully, to make kindness a higher priority. I also regret moments of dishonesty, which were not cataclysmic, yet somehow remain seared in my memory. Now I try to avoid placing new items on those mental shelves by working harder to do the right thing. I regret certain educational and professional choices that I made, but now I kick myself less for these blunders and use the lessons I learned to guide the rest of my life and to inform the advice I offer others. I regret not forging enough close connections with friends, mentors, and colleagues. Now I try harder to reach out. I regret not taking enough entrepreneurial and creative risks, not being as bold as my privilege allows and my heart desires. Now, stay tuned. After a few years immersed in the science and experience of our most misunderstood emotion, I've discovered about myself what I've discovered about others. Regret makes me human. Regret makes me better. Regret gives me hope. This is Daniel H. Pink. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Additional narration by Gisela Chipe, Edward Hong, Hilary Huber, Sarah Palermo, Alejandro Ruiz, Fred Sanders, Neil Shaw, Jade Wheeler, and Nancy Wu. This program was directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Edited by Elgin Productions Incorporated. Text copyright 2022 by Daniel H. Pink. Grateful acknowledgement is made for permission to include the following. Page 61. Tweet copyright 2020 by Ellie Crimendahl. Used with permission. Production copyright 2022. Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.